rise on behalf of the vast majority of the American people who believe that money is not speech, corporations are not people, and our democracy should not be for sale to the highest bidder. Overturn Citizens United.
That was a heckler speaking out and then being removed at the Supreme Court back in February. He was protesting the Citizens United case. That case was decided in January of 2010. It threw out limits on campaign spending for corporations and labor unions. Well, this morning, in another 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court threw out caps on overall campaign contributions by individuals. Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, cited the free speech protections of the First Amendment. He wrote, "There is no right in our democracy more basic than the right to participate in electing our political leaders." Speaking for the minority, Justice Stephen Breyer said this was a blow to democracy and the First Amendment. He said, "If the court in Citizens United opened a door, today's decision may well open a floodgate." Well, here to tell us more is Jessica Levinson. She teaches election law at Loyola Law School, and she's a member of the LA Ethics Commission. Hi, Jessica.
Good to be with you.
Well, before we get into this case, it's known as McCutcheon, can we start with a little bit of history? After Watergate, Congress passed campaign finance reform legislation. This was in the 1970s. And then the Supreme Court back then struck down parts of that law, upheld other parts. What was the overall message from the court back then?
That's exactly right. I'm so glad that you've asked me to hearken back to Watergate, because usually I do it of my own volition. So, you know, Watergate is actually a campaign finance scandal that brings down a presidency. And what always happens in cases of scandals is all of a sudden our representatives act. And they implemented in the early 1970s the nation's first comprehensive campaign finance scheme. And what I mean by that is essentially there were three pillars: contribution limits, which we'll obviously talk about today, expenditure limits that were severely hobbled as a result of Citizens United, and disclosure provisions, which is essentially all we have left in terms of limiting the influence of money in politics. And what the court said back in 1976 is that when I'm spending money, I'm actually speaking. And as a result of that, it means from that time forward, every time we try and limit the influence of money in politics, we're doing a First Amendment analysis. And you see Chief Justice Roberts saying, we can't have these aggregate contribution limits. We're trampling on speech rights. People on the other side of the aisle are saying, no, limits on how much you can spend, that's not actually money. And the limits can actually promote speech rights. So what we've seen, particularly since 2006, when Justice Alito replaced Justice O'Connor, is the court taking a very hostile view of restrictions on money. And, you know, as you mentioned, in 2010, striking down the limits on corporations and labor unions from spending, and then today, striking down restrictions that limit the total amount that we can give to candidates and political committees. So, you know, congratulations, top 0.001% of the 1%, you know, you can now spend unlimited sums giving to candidates.
So that's overall spending, but not, there are still limits on individual contributions to individual candidates, correct?
That's right. So if you're running for city council, assuming I wasn't on the Ethics Commission and I really want to support you, I'm still limited in the direct amount that I can give you. Let's say it's $1,500. But now what I can do is I can give you $1,500. I can give your opponent $1,500 if I want to hedge my bet. And I can give $1,500 to anyone else who's running for city council. And I don't have to worry about, oh, wait, I can only give $50,000 or $20,000 total to candidates. So the base contribution limits are really the only part of the Federal Election Campaign Act, and later changed by McCain-Feingold, that still stand, other than disclosure and transparency, which is going to have to do so much more work, I think, as a result of this decision.
So also, if I want to give a lot of money, I can give a lot of money to a group who can then disperse it, correct?
You absolutely can. Yes. So it was not like yesterday at this time, individual donors were not, in my mind, particularly handcuffed by the amount of money that they could spend in politics. You know, it used to be, you know, low 5 hours ago that you could give money, unlimited sums, to these quote unquote independent groups, super PACs, nonprofit organizations. And those, and I say, I use air quotes, although you can't see me, for independent groups, could then spend unlimited sums. And What the court said, and I think this actually makes some sense, is, okay, money flows so freely throughout our system. Can we really say that these aggregate contribution limits are doing much work now? And, you know, the court is able to say that, frankly, because it eroded so many other restrictions that now it can look at this one restriction and say, well, what's that really doing? Mm. So, yes, this is another, this case, in essence, talks about another mechanism through which we can pour money to candidates. And in this case, it's directly.
And I'm wondering, though, if this is a free speech argument that they're relying on, why have any limits at all? I mean, they kept these individual limits. Why did they keep them?
So the First Amendment, although it says it is not actually absolute. And what the court said back in 1976 is that when I give you money, it's not actually pure speech. It's speech by proxy. It doesn't become speech until you use it and you say, vote for Madeleine Brand because Press Play is taking off and I'm going to be a great city councilwoman. And so on the one hand, we have lower speech interests when it comes to contributors. And on the other hand, we have what the court has always said is a very important interest, and that's the interest in reducing corruption or its appearance. And the court and Chief Justice Roberts was pretty specific in saying we're not talking about the base contribution limits. I do think that if the next time we talk, it's about a big Supreme Court case in campaign finance, we will be talking about the base contributions. Mm-hmm. But the court has said for decades that both sides of the balance, the speaker's interest is lower and the government's interest is higher when it comes to contribution limits.
All right. So let's talk a little bit more locally. Does this just affect candidates for federal office or also for local office?
No, this is going to affect if it's the First Amendment, then localities don't get to infringe upon it. So this will affect candidates in every level, from city to county to state to federal. And, you know, one thing that we may see is it will be interesting to see exactly how this changes behavior and plays out. I think it will give the political parties a lot more power because party leaders can say, hey, why don't you give to us and not this super PAC who you don't control? So why don't you give to a party leadership committee and then, you know, we'll take care of your interests. So what we could see is that party leaders actually emboldened by this decision. And if that's the case, you know, some have said maybe that will lead to less gridlock. Maybe that will lead to fewer fringe candidates. So it will be really interesting to see how this changes behavior.
And will this go into effect immediately? So could it affect, for example, the race to replace Henry Waxman?
Yes, I think it could. I just got an email from the executive director of the LA Ethics Commission telling all our commissioners, looks like we should talk in light of the Supreme Court. So I think it could have a quick impact. And, you know, I hate to throw nothing but shade on this discussion, so maybe to throw a little sunshine on it. One argument is that now if people give directly to candidates, that money will be disclosed. So where we used to talk about dark money and money being filtered through nonprofits, maybe if people give directly to candidates, at least we'll know who they are. I'm a cynic, and I think it's probably not going to play out that way. Probably now people will use both the route of independent expenditures and direct contributions.
All right. Well, stay tuned. This is fast moving. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, speaking of sunshine, let's go to the Sunlight Foundation, a nonprofit that advocates for more open government. It's put together a list that tries to answer who exactly is going to take advantage of these new rules, the new Supreme Court decision. And the Sunlight Foundation has compiled the top 1,000 donors who could benefit most. Lisa Rosenberg is a lobbyist with the Sunlight Foundation. She joins me now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
And just to be clear where you're coming from, you, I understand, your foundation is not in favor of this Supreme Court decision.
No, absolutely not. You know, like your previous guest, we are extremely concerned that this just hands all of the power of our democracy to, you know, a few hundred extremely wealthy individuals and, you know, will let them basically have the ear of elected officials and decide which policies, not only which way the policies go, but which policies are even discussed in the first place. And we think it's a very, very dangerous decision.
So tell us about this top 1,000 list that you put together.
Well, we sort of put together a list of folks that had already maxed out or were coming very close to maxing out. In other words, giving the amounts that prior to today's Supreme Court's decision, you know, giving the maximum amount that they were allowed to give. So around $130,000, and that's to federal candidates is what we were looking at, and PACs and parties. And so we looked at them and figuring, well, they're kind of the most likely group to take advantage of a McCutcheon decision of a world with no limits, because obviously they've got the resources and they seem to have the political interest to do so.
Okay. And I'm wondering, in terms of political affiliation, did you break it down along those lines?
Well, we did. It seems though a majority of these big givers, these super donors, we like to call them, are giving to Republicans. There are definitely some Democratic super donors as well. And a few will hedge their bets and give to both parties. And that's, you know, that's part of the danger of this McCutcheon decision, actually, is that if you want to hedge your bets, you can give now, you know, millions of dollars to both parties and kind of get your message across no matter what happens, no matter who's elected. And it's a very risky proposition.
Now, people on the other side who are applauding this decision are saying, well, look, this is going to add more transparency to the process. We're going to know who these donors are. In fact, you just put together this list
right.
of who's giving and who they're giving to. So isn't that a good thing?
It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing from a very fundamental level of we are still in a position where probably 1,000 people will be buying our elections. So I don't think any citizen, any voter can think that that's a really good idea. But in terms of transparency, you know, even that's a problem. And right now we have to wait 3 months before candidates disclose who their donors are. So we don't know right away who's disclosing, I mean, who's giving candidate contributions. And one thing that the Sunlight Foundation is advocating, and we expect a bill will be introduced this week in Congress, is a bill that would require contributions of $1,000 or more to be disclosed in real time and online. Because, again, as your previous caller said, really disclosure is all that is left of our campaign finance system, but we need real-time disclosure to make it meaningful. So that people can react to these contributions before a bill is passed or before someone is actually elected. You know, 3 months can be too late and too long to wait. So we're really hoping that folks on Capitol Hill, you know, on both sides of the aisle, will see the importance of real-time or 48-hour disclosure of large contributions. But I would also add, and this is kind of demonstrating the naivete of some of the members of the Supreme Court, you know, they relied on the internet and on disclosure to support their decision to remove the limits. In the United States Senate, Senate candidates still file their disclosures on paper. Those papers have to be sent basically to the FEC, who then keys in the data. We at the Sunlight Foundation have been lobbying for years to get that overturned. The Senate has consistently blocked our efforts. It's really Senate Republicans in particular who are refusing to support electronic filing. So disclosure isn't adequate yet. We're not there yet. And that's another reason that we would need this disclosure bill that we're advocating.
Okay, let's talk about two of the Californians on your list, Nelson Rising and Charles Schwab. Who are these guys and what are their interests?
Sure. Well, Rising he's given, I think, to a mix of Democrats and Republicans, but he is one of those maxed out super donors who's given, you know, in the past election cycle as, you know, as much as he possibly can. And, you know, we think maybe he's likely to take advantage of the Supreme Court decision. Now, Rising is heavily involved in real estate transactions and commercial real estate, especially. So you have to think about it in that, you know, in that vein. Rising will be giving $1 million check, $2 million checks, $3 million checks to federal candidates. And while he's handing over that check, he's probably going to be saying something about, you know, boundaries or limits on space or use of commercial real estate space or, you know, something that will advance his interest. His
okay.
interest as a, you know, wealthy investor in commercial real estate,
right.
and commercial properties.
Right.
He's not going to be advocating for green space, probably, or homeless shelters or mixed use. You know, living spaces or things like that. The folks on the other side of the aisle, you know, you talk about free speech, their speech is going to be drowned out by folks like Rising, who could potentially give millions of dollars.
Lisa Rosenberg, lobbyist for the Sunlight Foundation, and that's a nonprofit that advocates for more open government. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, coming up on the program, shifting gears a little bit, Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac is just the latest movie about sexual compulsion. Is sex addiction finally moving into the mainstream, and how does it conform with reality? That's coming up on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac Part 1 opened in theaters last month, and the second part of his sex addiction drama opens this weekend.
If you have wings, why not fly?
If I asked you to take my virginity, would that be a problem?
No, I don't see a problem.
My name is Jo.
Hi, Jo. Hi, Jo.
And I'm a nymphomaniac.
Sex addict. We say sex addict.
It's not surprising that the bad boy of Danish cinema would take on a taboo subject and do it so explicitly, but the blade of his cutting edge might be dulled a little bit by the fact that sex addiction has been the focus of several mainstream films over the last several years. Shame, Thanks for Sharing, and Don John. We thought we'd take a look at these movies and what they mean with Matt Holzman. He's one of our producers here at Press Play and host of KCRW's First Take screening series. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Madeline. You know, before we started talking about the movies, though, I want to kind of clarify terms.
What do you mean?
Well, the term sex addiction is not a term that everyone accepts already. There's some argument about it because there hasn't been enough medical research to really put a kind of science stamp on it as an addiction. It's not on the DSM, which is the kind of Bible of the psychiatric trade. So some people like Rory Reed, who I talked to, who's a researcher at UCLA, prefers the term hypersexual behavior. But he's also a person who sees patients. So the one thing I do want to make clear is no matter what you call it, he says, and everyone I talk to says, it's very, very real.
We know of a lot of patients who have consumed pornography in the workplace despite multiple warnings from human resources, and they ultimately lose their jobs. We know that there's been people that have spent such an extensive amount of time pursuing sexual activities that they neglect other important tasks and responsibilities in their lives, including parenting and so forth. So these people definitely experience a substantial amount of pain and suffering.
So this is a real problem, a real mental illness?
Well, again, we can't really put a definition on it, but we do know that this is something that happens to people and that they suffer consequences from. Just so we're also clear about what we're talking about chronic use of pornography. We're talking about frequenting sex workers or serial cheating or more extreme fetish behaviors. A lot of this is very adrenalized or some combination of all the above.
But then aren't there people who just say that sex addiction is just an excuse for people who like sex a lot or weird sex or what have you, and that, you know, it's kind of a moral judgment?
Well, yes, there are people who say that. But I talked to Alex Katahakis, who runs a place called the Center for Healthy Sex here in L.A. She's been treating people with sex addiction for more than 15 years. And by the way, she has no problem with the term sex addiction. That's a term she uses freely. But she says those old stereotypes about this behavior are really fading away, and that she, as a clinician, has no interest in moralizing. It's only when people come to her in pain that she stands up and says, okay, I'm willing to help.
I don't know that many people are saying that sex addiction is an excuse for bad behavior as much as they once were. I think if that said, it's in the popular culture. It's something you might read in a women's magazine. And I think that's just the language of ignorance, mostly. And if someone says, I'm devoutly single, I like having varied sex, anonymous sex, sex with sex workers, this is the life I'm choosing to live, then there's no problem.
Okay, let's get back to the movies.
Right.
And what did these two think of these movies?
Well, they were really happy that the movies had come out. They were really happy that it's kind of part of our cultural conversation. They had good and bad things to say about all of them. And let's start with Shame, which is the really, really intense film that came out in 2012. It's from Steve McQueen.
The director of 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, do you want to play?
Your hard drive is filthy. I mean, it is dirty.
Slowly.
So probably the real strength of this film is that it really goes inside sex addiction and the kind of the motivating pain of the addiction. Here's Rory Reed of UCLA.
Clinically, we talk about shame as being different from guilt insofar as guilt says my behavior's bad. Shame says I'm bad. We see clinically that people turn to sex as a way to kind of self-medicate or escape or disconnect from feelings of worthlessness.
And you see that over and over in all of these movies. And, you know, the thing is so you have shame, you act out sexually, it increases the shame, and it's just it's a vicious cycle.
All right. What about this other movie, Don John?
So Don John came out, let's see, at the end of last year. It was Joseph Gordon-Levitt's directorial debut. And this is a totally different movie than Shame. It's very fun. He plays this super slick Jersey kid who lands the neighborhood's like hottest girl, played by Scarlett Johansson, but he really prefers his porn.
There's only a few things I really care about in life. My body, my pad, my ride, my family, my church, my boys, my girls, and my porn.
So this is one of those movies that falls into that trap where you've got the big stars and it's really fun and accessible. So people went to see it. And of all the movies we're going to talk about, this is the movie that most people have seen. But the problem also is, as commercial culture, they take shortcuts, right? They wrap everything up in a nice little bow. So at the end of this movie, he meets a real woman. It's Julianne Moore. And she kind of cures him of his porn addiction. And Alex Katahakis, one of the therapists that I talked to, says it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I think it is dangerous to simplify that somebody can stop looking at pornography. He would then be able to be with a real woman. Is good for cinema. But the truth is that it takes a long time for the brain to heal itself. Life is not that simple. And the internet is much more tenacious than that.
So did she and Rory, did they have a favorite of these movies?
Well, I'm kind of leaving Nymphomaniac out of the running because we all saw part one, but we haven't seen part two yet, and it really is a movie that's cleaved kind of in half. So we left that one out. But they both absolutely said Thanks for Sharing. And Thanks for Sharing also came out at the end of last year. It's a dramedy with Mark Ruffalo and Tim Robbins as members of a 12-step group for sex addicts.
Is that a sobriety medallion?
I've been in recovery for 5 years.
For what?
Sex addiction.
Isn't that something that guys just say when they get caught cheating?
Hey, Adam, sex addict.
Hey, Adam.
There's a lot of dudes in here. My other program isn't such a sausage fest.
So by the way, the girlfriend was Gwyneth Paltrow, and the woman at the end, that's actually Pink, in a role as a female sex addict. So Rory Reed really liked this movie because it did show the kind of diversity of people who are affected by the disease.
The reason I appreciate it is I think they did a nice job with blending some humor with some serious issues. They had several different people that struggle with these issues, so you got a chance to see how it manifests in various kinds of contexts, including a woman who struggled with this issue. And they all had different kind of patterns of things that kind of influenced them to engage in sexually dysregulated behavior.
But Alex Katahakis kind of acknowledged that for the same reasons that they both liked, she and Rory both liked Thanks for Sharing, for the average moviegoer, it might be missing a little something.
I guess as a general film goer, if you knew nothing about 12-step recovery, sex and Sex Addicts Anonymous, Thanks for Sharing probably wouldn't do much for you. I think there were so many insider jokes and knowings in that movie, that's what made it ring true to me.
So why so many of these movies right now? Did Rory or Alex hazard a guess?
Well, they think that more and more people are being affected by it. I believe the writer, maybe even the director of Thanks for Sharing, if he's the same person, is a person actually in a 12-step program for sex addiction, and just generally more people are affected by it. But there is kind of just there's more awareness of this stuff. When we think about, you know, even Bill Clinton and Tiger Woods and Bob Filner, the former mayor of San Diego, people just are hearing more about this stuff. And so there's a better awareness. And so movies tend to reflect popular culture. And this is part of our popular culture. But they also added that, you know, these movies are talking about awareness, but they in no way indicate anything like acceptance.
When people say, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 5, 10, 20 years, people say congratulations, and they pat them on the back, and they're proud of them. But nobody walks into a room and says, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I've been in recovery from sex addiction for 3 years, because they're afraid people will run and hide or judge them or hide their children.
You know, she also added that sex addiction is really waiting for its Betty Ford. And in the meantime, the drug seems to be getting stronger. There's more of it. You know, kids have access to it at an earlier age. Anything you could possibly desire is available at the click of a button. But the main takeaway that I got both from Alex and Rory Reed, Alex Katahakis and Rory Reed, was that, you know, it's good that the movies are out there and that if people see them and identify with this idea of sexual addiction, that there is help.
for those that are struggling and feel that their sexual behavior is out of control and causing problems for them, I would just say there's help, and that that help is a process, and it requires a lot of energy and effort. Many of these folks didn't develop these problems overnight, and they're not going to change their patterns overnight. But if they're committed to, you know, putting in the energy and effort and the sacrifices required, that change is possible.
I guess, Matt, I come away from this wondering about the movie's role in this, because on the one hand, it's highlighting this problem, if you want to call it that, because you're not calling it a disease, of sex addiction. And yet it's also glorifying it. It's making it into a movie that you want to go see, and you want to see beautiful people having sex.
But isn't that true of popular culture? I mean, it always really at the same time has the power to help heal problems and create them. And the question is, in these movies, which are they doing? It's hard to know exactly.
Nymphomaniac Part 2 comes out this weekend, and we have links to all the other movies at our blog, which you can find at kcrw.com. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, teens and sleep. Science shows that their brains are different when it comes to sleep, that they actually have to go to bed later than most of us. Now some schools are pushing back the start of the school day. That story coming up on Press Play after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Teenagers who sleep in on the weekends or fall asleep in class during the week are not necessarily lazy bums. A growing body of research suggests that their brains are different, wired to stay up later. And yet, school starts really early, so a lot of teens aren't getting enough sleep. Some schools are now changing their start time, so classes start later. And one of them is the high school in Glens Falls, New York. Liz Collins is the assistant principal at Glens Falls High. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Kyla Wallstrom. She's director of the Center for Applied Research and Education Improvement at the University of Minnesota. And she recently completed a study of students at 8 high schools that moved their start times back. Welcome to you, Kyla.
Pleasure to be with you.
All right, let's start with you, Liz, at Glens Falls High. What's the new start time and what was it before?
The new start time is 8:26, and previously it was 7:45.
And is that a big enough difference to notice a difference in terms of your students' outcomes, their educational attainments?
We definitely have seen some very positive changes with our student body since we've changed the start time. Clearly, we would have liked longer, but this seemed to be the best compromise to work with all the different factors.
So what kinds of changes have you noticed?
Well, we've noticed that the number of students who are actually tardy to school has decreased. The percentage of failures has dropped in the different grades. Teachers are reporting that students are more alert in their AM classes. We also have been working with St. Lawrence University on a sleep study and are just in the middle of collecting, you know, the final findings of that. But in our initial findings, the students are reporting to having an increase in the number of minutes that they're actually sleeping each night, between 12 and 48 minutes, depending on the different grade levels.
And Kyla Wallstrom, 12 and 48 minutes, that doesn't sound like a lot, but can that make a big difference?
Sure. You know, it's very interesting in the studies that we've been doing, and we've been studying this for about 17 years, the amount of sleep that a teen gets, every little bit helps in a school night or on a per-night basis. So the fact that they're getting anywhere from 12 to 48 minutes is absolutely beneficial, And Liz Collins has mentioned is exactly in harmony with all the findings we've found over the last 17 years.
Okay, now describe, tell us the science behind this, the fact that teenagers' brains are developing and they're different and they may actually need to go to sleep later in the evening than we do.
Right. Well, it's interesting. The first studies that were done on the teenage brain, finding out how different it is from either a preteen, an elementary child, or an adult, was emerging in the early 1990s. And what the researchers in the medical sleep labs found is that teenagers do not have a secretion of melatonin. That is the hormone that signals the brain to fall asleep. Their melatonin secretion does not occur until 10:45 or 11 at night. That's true for all human beings on this planet. So it isn't just an American phenomenon. This is true of all human development. By the same token, the melatonin secretion is very strong until 8 in the morning. So there's this window of time of about 9 hours that the human body and the teenage body in particular is in a sleep mode. So the biology is such that you can't, those are incontrovertible changes. Those are changes that will not cannot be made to happen earlier. So sending a child to bed early doesn't work. And I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of kids who will say their parents send them to bed, and they will be laying in bed looking at the ceiling until about 10:45 or 11, which is about the time the melatonin begins to secrete.
And does that happen with puberty?
Yes. It's exactly linked with puberty. And in fact, the melatonin secretion signal gets even stronger as teens move through puberty. So in ages of 13, 14, you get some of this changing in the middle schools, but you get it very strongly by the time that teens are 16, 17, and 18.
So the optimal time for them to be sleeping is between 11 p.m. and 8 a.m.?
Correct.
And yet they're probably all getting up well before 8 a.m. to get to school.
Probably.
Right. And so if this research has been around for a long time, why haven't we changed the school start times in all of our schools?
Great question, and I'm sure Liz can speak to this. Changing the timing of the starting time of any school, high school or middle school or elementary, it's changing the norms of the community. And it's very difficult to get people to understand that this is a biological phenomenon, and in fact, making a change does change bus schedules, lunch schedules, daycare, work schedules. A whole variety of things get changed as a result of changing the starting time.
And Liz, how hard was it to change the start time, given all of these other considerations? Because also, don't kids have after-school sports, which would then be pushed back as well?
Yes. This was actually a two-year process that we started, not really realizing that it was going to be such an emotional change and difficult for the community to make that change. But I would definitely agree with Kayla that that was probably the hardest part, was getting people to make that adjustment, that this was a biological need for the students and this would be best for them, and just changing the schedules and students and parents and teachers' routines was extremely difficult.
So the community was against it?
Well, I wouldn't say the entire community was against it, but there were definitely very strong pockets of people who were against it. We did have a large student body, mostly the athletes and the students who are very involved in their academics and in extracurricular activities were initially much opposed, so much that they even held a rally outside of school one morning to show their disagreement with the change. The school board actually voted two different times, and it was passed by one vote each time. So it was a very controversial issue.
And so now that you've done it, have the critics quieted?
It's very quiet. It's almost as though it's always been. And, you know, certainly there's people who still say that they're opposed, but currently with our student body, the 11th and 12th graders are the only group of students that, you know any different and knew what it was like to come earlier. So for the 9th and 10th graders, their start time is exactly the same as it was for their middle school years. You know, I think one of the big things that's wonderful about it is we have the kids, there's still some kids, there's still some teachers that come to school early. But the whole pace of the entrance to the day or the beginning of the day is much calmer. Kids and students are flowing into the building at a much more humane pace, and it just is a great day, way to start the day.
And Kyla, you have just completed a study of several states. And what did you find in terms of the outcomes on the part of the students? How did things change after
they
pushed their start
time? Well, the outcomes are remarkable in that, just as Liz Collins was mentioning in her high school, we did find statistically significant improvements in grades earned in the core subjects of English, math, social studies, and science in periods 1 and 3. And keep in mind that we looked at data from 9,000 high school students in 3 states, and so we have a very strong database by which to be making these conclusions. The other thing that I think is very remarkable to note is that the car crash rate in 2 of the 5 high schools that we were in reduced in one case by 65 and in the other case by 70% reduction in car crashes that were involving teenagers during the school year. And that is a remarkable, remarkable finding that's brand new, that's just out as a result of this most recent study as well.
So that's really incredible. So when you present these findings, this is a life and death matter.
It is. And, you know, it isn't kids just crashing their cars, but they're crashing into us, too, you know.
Yeah.
So, and that's why the study was funded by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, because they saw sleepy teens as a public health hazard. The other thing, speaking of public health, that is important is the kids that were getting the most sleep in this study were also the ones at least risk of using drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, and so on. So the choices for risky behavior drop significantly when the kids are getting 8 or more hours of sleep every night.
And then you also found that it impacts on depression.
Yes, we found statistically significantly less depression, again, in students that were getting greater than 8 hours of sleep. And, you know, it's just pretty amazing how this is hits all segments of the student, you know, their learning, their emotional stability, their choices that they're making. And the parents, 92% of the parents said their kids are easier to live with as a result of the change. So it's just seems to be positive on almost every front.
Right. I mean, it seems to make sense that you get more sleep and you're just healthier all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So any other schools, school districts that you know of thinking of doing this?
Well, I can say that in the last 17 years, I've been contacted by more than 300 to 400 school districts who are curious about the research and the information. And the National Sleep Foundation was keeping data records up until 2005, and they had 250 schools that had made the change across the United States up until 2005 when they stopped collecting that data. So it's a national phenomenon.
All right. I want to thank you both very much for joining us today. Really interesting.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
That's Liz Collins. She's assistant principal at Glens Falls High School in Glens Falls, New York. And Kyla Wahlstrom. She's a lecturer and director of the Center for Applied Research and Education Improvement at the University of Minnesota. No sleeping at 1 o'clock because Warren Olney will be with you.
We will keep you awake at least from 1 to 2. Interesting, you got into public health issues there. We're going to be talking about a very lively public health issue, which has to do with vaccines. You know, measles are beginning to show up again in the United States after having been virtually eliminated 14 years ago. And it's because some parents are choosing not to have their kids vaccinated, despite the fact that it is recommended by the CDC and the vast majority of pediatricians and doctors. It's a very interesting controversy. And in addition to that, there is a shortage of vaccines for other reasons in other places. Polio is beginning to be almost epidemic in some parts of the world, largely because of domestic violence, but also, I mean, violence among the in those countries. But also because of religious objections and what happened in Pakistan with the with Osama bin Laden, where they used a guy that was supposed to be vaccinating people to find out where Osama bin Laden was. People who vaccinate in Pakistan are now subject to being killed by the Taliban. That's an interesting issue. Different aspect of the same issue.
Wow, fascinating. Okay, stay tuned for that. 1 o'clock, To the Point and Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, sort of a similar story. People who are in favor of raw milk. We're going to talk about raw milk's two bills about raw milk to legalize the sale of it across state lines. And we'll talk about whether drinking it is a good idea, why people want to make it legal, coming up on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandwell, and you scarfed your bowl of cornflakes this morning, standing up maybe and leaning over the sink, if you're anything like me. What kind of milk did you use? Was it whole? Was it skim? It probably wasn't raw milk. Raw milk meaning unpasteurized. It's only legal in around half of the states. Here in California, there are a few farms that can sell raw milk to consumers, but they have to go through a rigorous health check. And there are two proposed laws now in Washington that would make it legal to sell raw milk across state lines. But the bills are being hotly contested by mainstream ag and some health experts. Tarini Pardi, an agriculture reporter for Politico, has been writing about this story, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why is raw milk so controversial?
Well, it's, you know, it's been controversial for years. This is not a new thing, but basically, you know, it's unpasteurized milk. It's exposed to a lot of germs in the production process. And so health experts for years have said that this is not safe to drink. But a lot of people insist that they don't believe exactly in the scientific evidence and have continued to say that it's actually better for you than regular milk, pasteurized milk.
Well, let's talk about that and try to peel that apart. How dangerous is it, according to health experts?
Well, the CDC reported in 2012 that of the 121 dairy-associated foodborne illnesses, more than 1,500 people who were sickened were as a result of raw milk. And actually, that resulted in two deaths.
So 1,500 people were sickened from raw milk over a period of 13 years.
Yes.
And how do you compare that to other foodborne problems, let's say with other food like spinach or meat, deli meat?
So it's all about the location of where this is coming from, right? So milk, it comes from a more contaminated area, an area that is more prone to germs. You know, spinach, obviously grown in the ground, not as exposed to fecal contamination as milk is. And so the pasteurization helps kill those germs and makes the milk safer.
Is that significant then for the government to say, look, this is dangerous and we should keep it pasteurized?
So that's what they've been saying for the last few years. But what's interesting about this new discussion is that the whole topic has shifted from, you know, the safety concerns to being more about freedom of choice. So that's where the libertarians come in. That's where a lot of liberal members of the House, you know, who think that FDA perhaps is spending too much money on regulating this particular, you know, raw milk industry when they could be doing more to protect people in terms of other kinds of food safety.
So that's an interesting combination of advocates for raw milk. You've got the libertarians on one side, and then you have a lot of liberal people who like to eat organic food, who like raw milk, also on that side.
Definitely. And, you know, another thing that's driving this sort of liberal movement is that some of these people who, you know, believe, like you said, in the more organic, local farming way of life, they think that drinking raw milk is sort of, you know, poking a stick in the eye of big ag. So mm-hmm. they don't like these big companies. They don't like, you know, these big dairy associations that spend a lot of money lobbying on Capitol Hill. So they're kind of ignoring the safety aspect of it and looking at it more from a freedom of choice choice perspective.
But I think they also think that there are clear health benefits to drinking raw milk.
There are some of those people as well. You know, some people have called it magic food before. You know, a lot of people very strongly believe that, you know, it can cure certain illnesses and the government shouldn't have any right to regulate it. But those people are, you know, they exist. They are now not as much a part of this conversation because, like I said, it's moving on to becoming more of a freedom of choice issue rather than a food safety issue.
And what does Big Dairy have to say about all this?
Well, they're clearly not happy. And one interesting thing to note was that when these proposals came out, the dairy industry was very quick in responding. They immediately criticized these two proposals, when in the past, when people like Ron Paul have mentioned raw milk or when he proposed the bill in the House, they just largely ignored it. But now that it has some Democratic support, they're a little bit more concerned and were very quick to respond.
Who's sponsoring this legislation?
So it's Thomas Massey, of a Republican from Kentucky. But, you know, he does have some Democrats, the biggest one being Representative Shelley Pingree of Maine.
And people seem to get really emotional over these topics when it comes to what they eat and whether the government should be regulating it, whether, you know, it should be labeled organic or non-organic and all that kind of stuff. Are you seeing that on Capitol Hill? Are you seeing an emotional debate on this issue?
Definitely. It's been very interesting to watch how the topic of food and nutrition in general has just escalated here in D.C. from the First Lady Michelle Obama announcing a lot of proposals the past few years, but specifically even in the last few weeks related to food, from what goes into the school lunch program to, you know, what you see on labels at the grocery store. There's a lot of regulation and, you know, a lot of conservatives are continuing to call it the nanny state and that food shouldn't be regulated as much as it is. But on the other hand, we have childhood obesity is increasing and, you know, nutrition and food safety continue to be a big part of that discussion.
Okay, so where is this in the legislative process? How likely is it that it'll be voted on?
So, you know, it really doesn't seem to be gaining quite as much traction just yet. But the fact that it has some Democratic sponsors is a huge deal. And, you know, even if these two bills in particular that have just been introduced don't go too far along in the legislative process, when this comes up again, it could have more Democratic sponsors. So, you know, compared to where we were a few years ago, it's definitely gained a lot of traction.
Tarina Pardi, agriculture reporter for Politico. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right, so that's the national picture. What about here at home? Patty Chelseth is co-owner of My Sister's Farm in Shingle Springs, and that's near Sacramento. She joins me now. Hi, Patty.
Hi.
And you run something called a herd share on your farm where people can get raw milk without having to go to the store. How does that work?
Well, the herd share is where the cows are owned by the people, and they pay the farmer to take care of their cows, including milking it and such. So that's kind of how that works out. It's not legal in this state to sell milk, unless you are from a licensed dairy, but it is legal to drink the milk from your own cow. And so that's how the herd shares operate in this state right now, although the CDFA does not recognize it, and if it ends up going to court someday, I think the herd shares will prevail. But in the meantime, they're out there looking for us, and you know, they issue cease and desist and such.
Ooh, so this is the California
Department of Food and Ag.
Okay, I see. So, but you're trying to get the law changed, I understand.
Yes, I am. There's quite a group of us. But this stemmed from a cease and desist order that I received and six other goat dairy people throughout about back in 2011, where we all received cease and desist letters from the state, and they said shut her down. In my county, I have two cows, so I couldn't technically be a dairy if I wanted to, and the cost of becoming a dairy for two or three cows runs into several hundred thousand dollars because it's for the facilities. And
so they're saying that the herd share program that you're doing is not legal?
They aren't. No. Well, in my county, it is. We codified it after this happened.
So what do you want changed in California?
What we want is for people with the law that is actually coming forward, AB 2505, it actually is originally started, hopefully, as an exemption, but that we changed in the process to create safety standards so that the thousands of us who are out here in the state are able to come basically out of the barn, talk to each other, teach each other the best practices, and create better access
to this healthful food for those who choose it, and at the same time keeping it safe, although inherently it's not very dangerous. If you look at statistics, the ones she quoted, 1,500 people sick in 13 years, and you look in 1 year, there's several million who get sick with general foodborne type diseases. Mm-hmm. So milk is all in all fairly safe. Raw milk is also fairly safe if you look at it statistically against other foods.
Although some people have said, you know, maybe that's true, but it's still a game of Russian roulette in the sense that you could be exposed to really bad pathogens, E. coli, Listeria, Salmonella.
Okay, well, and this is another thing. Listeria has never been found in raw milk. It's usually in the cheeses, the fresh cheeses that have been fermented. That is an acidic environment type bacteria, although they always put it in there. Campylobacter and E. coli are the two biggies. And with a clean operation, those are just not very common. Is it possible? I guess in some situations it is possible, but everything is possible, and you can get hit by a car a whole lot more easily than.
But you can also drink pasteurized milk, so why take the risk?
Why take the risk of doing pasteurized over raw? Well, if you look on the FDA website, milk is the number one food allergy in the nation, basically meaning pasteurized milk. Raw milk actually stabilizes the mast cells, which are the cells that kind of inflame for allergies. And so raw milk is used to calm that in many cases. But so many people cannot tolerate pasteurized milk, and they are very able to drink the raw milk. I've had many of our people that are herd chair owners here that they found us, and they wanted it because either their children were asthmatics or they themselves were milk intolerant. And they're able now to drink this milk because the enzymes are actually in there to let you digest it. So people who are lactose intolerant, when they drink raw milk, they can drink it. And
okay.
They don't get upset that stomachs and stuff from it.
All right. Sadly, we have run out of time. Patty Chelseth, co-owner of My Sister's Farm in Shingle Springs near Sacramento. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get to the mail with Julie Myers. Hi.
Okay, not a lot of time today, I just want to say that I'm not such a milk fan at all, so I don't have to make the choice between pasteurized or raw. And that's basically what we have for feedback today.
That's it?
We had a lot of stuff about the sleep thing, but we're out of time, you guys, so you'll have to tune in tomorrow to hear the show and hear what the feedback on sleep was.
All right. Okay. Well, we definitely want to hear from you, so you can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or weigh in on our Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and that's it. More and all news up next with To The Point, and I'll see you tomorrow.